We now begin Maseches Trumos, and this will be the introduction to the Masechta. The word Truma means a gift or a donation, literally and in modern Hebrew, but it has the connotation of elevation, to lift something up, like the word Laharim means lift up, or Romamut, etc. So Trumot are gifts that imply having been uplifted. And they could refer to many things, but in our context of our Masechta, Trumos refers specifically to portions that are given to the Kohen. It could refer to one of four types of gifts, really. The primary being Truma Gadola. I'll go back to defining these a little more later on, but in case you aren't familiar. But it could be Truma Gadola, Trumas Miser, as well as Chala and Bikurim. Are all basically called Truma in the Torah, and a very similar dinim. I'll come back to those. The actual name Trumos is plural, presumably because of the Pasuk, the verse referring to Trumos presents Klal Yisrael with a charge to Mishmeres Trumosai, the guarding of the Trumos plural, and referring both to the requirements of certain mitzvahs that apply to Truma while it's Tahor and other mitzvahs that apply to Truma while it's Tamei. So presumably the Trumos is referring to those two types of Trum, which are different halachas. Come back to that also. The Rambam counts 8 separate mitzvahs that are associated with Truma in his Hilchos Trumos, and in fact he has others elsewhere as well. So the Rambam lists those 8 mitzvahs as being as follows. First of all, the mitzvah to separate Truma, as well as the mitzvah of Truma Gadola, as well as the mitzvah to separate Trumas Meiser. The third mitzvah is to do those, the different tithes, in order, in the proper order. The fourth, that a zer, that is someone who's not a Kohen, may not eat Truma. Only the Kohen in his household can eat Truma. The fifth mitzvah is not even someone who works for the Kohen, but not strictly part of his household proper, may eat Truma. The sixth is, even if a person is a Kohen, he may not eat Truma if he hasn't been circumcised, is an Aral. The seventh, that a Kohen, even if he has been circumcised, may not eat Truma if he is Tamei, ritually impure at the time. And the eighth, that a Chalala, a woman who comes from the household of a Kohen, but has left the household through marriage to a non-Kohen, etc., is now no longer permitted to eat Truma, at least while she's part of that household. Those are the Rambam's 8 mitzvahs. But there'll be other mitzvahs that apply to Truma that the Rambam doesn't count here. He counts elsewhere in the larger topic of kadshim, of general sanctified foods from the Beis HaMikdash, specifically both the mitzvah to keep them tahor as well as the prohibition against making them tamei. So a good number of mitzvahs here. So just to understand now, to take a step back, let's just talk about, explain what we're talking about here, and for those who aren't familiar at all. There's a series of mitzvahs around taking different, I'll call them tithes, separations, or tithes from produce that grows in Eretz Yisrael. And midoraisa, the mitzvahs of Truma, are mitzvahs tuluyas ba'aretz, mitzvahs that depend on Eretz Yisrael, and outside of Eretz Yisrael they do not apply, at least midoraisa. Midorabanan, however, the neighboring countries or lands around Israel, including Bavel, which is modern-day Iraq, what the Rambam calls Shinar, as well, which is obligated midorabanan in Trumos, at least in time of Gemara it certainly was, as well as Mitzrayim to the south, Egypt, as well as what is now modern-day Jordan, so that is Ammon and Moab, are also required derabanan there to the east, as well as Syria, which is what's called modern-day Syria, approximately, to the north. All those have rabbinic requirements. But putting that aside, midoraisa, from a Torah perspective, the mitzvahs that depend on the land, including trumos, etc., are all only in Eretz Yisrael proper, and we're talking about land that was reconquered by the Jews who came back from Babel, Babylonia, after the first exile. That is to say, even if you had land which was taken when Joshua came up from Mitzrayim the first time, when the Jews left Eretz Yisrael under the Babylonians, so they the land lost its sanctification and reverts back to being just land with the potential to be sanctified, but in fact, only that. So when the Jews come back, the Olei Bavel, they return after the, from the Babylonian and then the Persian exile, they come back 7 years later. The land which they reconquer as a nation, that's the land that gets sanctified anew. And in fact, there's a question if, after the second exile, if the Kedusha that the land was invested with persists, and that would be a Kedusha Lasid Lavo, a permanent sanctification of the land, or whether it was just a Kedusha L'Sha'ata, a temporary sanctification which ends when the Jews are exiled. The Rambam learns that the Kedusha that the land was invested with the second time was Lasid Lavo, it was a permanent sanctification of the land, and therefore all of Eretz Yisrael that was possessed by the Olei Bavel, the ones who came back in the Second Commonwealth, that land does have the potential to be required midoraisa for trumas, etc. But even then, the Rambam holds that the halachas of truma, etc., doesn't apply unless the majority of Jews are back in Eretz Yisrael, and that actually is not quite the case yet, as it hasn't been since the first exile, which means the Rambam will learn, and let's assume this is the halacha lamaisa, that's the Mechaber Paskins for sure, that in Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah of Truma hasn't been a Torah requirement or a Doraisa requirement since the first exile some 2,500 years ago. And that would mean, of course, that when the Gemara, Mishnah, etc. discuss, these mitzvahs are talking only Midurabanan. In any case, so let's just go through what happens. And I'm going to put a little handout. I hope I will include a handout here with the recordings here so you can see how the hafrashos go, the different tithes go. But here's just in a nutshell. Let's say a person has a crop. Now, the Torah actually specifies specifically three crops. The Pasuk in Devarim, in Devarim 18.4, specifies specifically three things from which one must give truma to the Kohen. That is dagan, grain, so we're talking, wheat or barley grain, as well as tirosh, which is wine, and yitzhar, which is oil, olive oil. So the Torah specifies those three types of produce from which one must give truma. And many Rishonim learn that that is the only types of produce for which truma is a mitzvah d'oraisa. And other, let's say, fruits, like if you have a fig, and certainly vegetables, are just rabbinically required to tithe. There are some Rishonim hold that those three are just archetypes for all seven of the fruits by which Eretz Yisrael is praised. That would be olives, dates, figs, grapes, pomegranates, in addition to wheat and barley. And the Shita of the Rambam, Rambam's opinion is that it actually applies to essentially all grains and fruits are all obligated to be tithed, and legumes, etc., kidneys, all required to be tithed, take the truma from, etc., on a Doraisa level. The Rambam holds just yirakos, vegetables, which are only rabbinically required to tithe. Whatever the case, the halacha is, once you bring in the derabbanan, that all produce that comes from the ground, leaving some unusual exceptions, but in general, all cultivated produce that grows in the ground has to be tithed at least midirabbanan. So the tithing has a number of steps and a number of different gifts. So let's say now you have, for argument's sake, 100 gallons of wine, which you produce in your land in Eretz Yisrael. So now you need to tithe it. So the first tithe you'll take is truma. It's called truma gedola, the first primary truma. Gedola here meaning primary, which according to Torah law midoraisa has no minimum shiur. You can give as little as you want. Even one grain from your grain harvest, a single kernel of grain, could exempt the entire harvest from truma gedola requirements. Midoraisa. There's no measurement. There's no requirements. One grain will be enough. Midrabanan, the rabbi said a person should give, if he's the average person, should be giving 2%, what we call 1/50th, 1/50. And if a person is generous, he'll give 1/40th, 2.5%. And if he's stingy, then he'll give a 1/60th, which would be like called 1.7%. And that applies to whatever is required midraisa to be given trumas. A person should give typically 1/50th, 2%. As truma gedola. Everyone agrees that that which is only required midrabanan, whatever that would entail, would only require 1/60th as a gift to the kohanim. In any case, so let's say you have your 100 gallons of wine. You would take now 2% or 2 of the 100 gallons and set them aside as truma gadola for the Kohen. You're left with 98 gallons of wine, and those 98 gallons have to be, other gifts have to be taken from them. The next proper gift to take is called Maaser Rishon, the first tithe. Maaser, like from the word eser, 10, like a tenth, is indeed 1/10 of what remains goes to the Levi. So if you had 98 left, because you gave 2 set aside for the Kohen, of your 98, you give 10%, meaning 9.8 gallons, and set that aside for a Levi. And the Levi will take 10% of his gift, meaning a tenth of his tenth. If he got 9.8, he'll give 0.98 gallons of wine, also to the Kohen. The Levi's gift is called Trumas Maaser, the Truma gift from his Maaser, from his tenth. And the halachas of Truma Gedola, the portion that comes from the Yisrael, and Trumas Maaser, the portion that comes from the Levi, is exactly the same. There's essentially no difference whatsoever between the halachic status or the halachas that apply to Truma Gedola and Trumas Maaser, other than the origin of Truma Gedola is the gift that came from Yisrael, whereas the origin of the Trumas Maaser is the gift to the Kohen that came from the Levi. So if you do the math, you figure out that the Kohen gets a total of, let's say, 2.98 gallons, two as the first 2% from the Yisrael, as well as 0.98, the tenth of what was left that came from the Levi. The Levi's left with his residual. He got 9.8, he gives 0.9 away, so he's left with 8.82. After that, there'll be another tithe given. Now, that tithe is not really the topic or relevant to our Masechta, but that will be the second tithe. And more specifically, and just for completeness, let's explain it over here. The Jewish agricultural cycle is a 7-year cycle. In the 7th year, Shvias, we just discussed the previous Masechta, there are no tithes to be taken. In the 7th year, in the Shemitah year, there's no Truma or Maaser to be taken. But in the other years, the 6 other years, those 6 years are divided into 2 3-year mini-cycles, the first 2 of which one gives Maaser Sheni, the second tithe, and the 3rd of each of those mini-cycles, 3rd year of each of those mini-cycles, a person gives Maaser Ani. Maaser Sheni, the second tithe, is the Yisrael keeps it, but he must eat that produce in Jerusalem, or he could redeem it onto coins and take the coins to Jerusalem, but it's for eating in Jerusalem by him, the Yisrael. And Maaser Ani is the tithe for the poor that's given in the 3rd and 6th year and is eaten by poor people. So then it'll come out then that in years 1, 2, and then 4 and 5 of the 7-year cycle, one separates Maaser Sheni after Maaser Rishon, Maaser Rishon to the Levi, Maaser Sheni set aside for consumption in Yerushalayim. And then in years 3 and 6, Maaser Ani is separated after Maaser Rishon, after the Kohen and Levi get their portions, one sets aside in years 3 and 6 portions for the poor. Again, it's a tenth of what's left. So since, and that's true for both Maaser Sheni and Maaser Ani, it's a tenth of what's left. So our Yisrael, who had 100, gave 2 to the Kohen as Truma Gedola. He's left with 98. He gives a tenth of that, 9.8, to the Levi. He's left with now 88.2, and he'll give a tenth of that, meaning 8.82, to either Maaser Sheni in years 1, 2, 4, and 5, or Maaser Ani in years 3 and 6. And then the original owner of the Yisrael will be left with 79.38 of totally unencumbered produce for his consumption. Again, I'll send out a handout, and if you're not familiar, please make a close study of that handout, because for the rest of the whole Seder of Surah, I'm going to need to know this stuff very well. Okay. So, now, again, we're talking about Trumos, and we're referring now to the halachas that apply to primarily that Truma Gedola, as well as the Trumas Maaser. So, and again, very similar halachas apply to the challah portion, which is a gift given from the dough. But in any case, let's focus on Truma and Trumas Maaser here. When we say Truma, usually it just means either Truma Gedola or Truma Gedola and Trumas Maaser, both. It's pretty interchangeable. So, this Truma has a special kedusha, has a sanctity, which is kind of like Kudshim light, meaning it's kind of like Kudshim. It's not Kudshim at all. It's not belong to Mizbech, goes to the Kohen, and it's not a sacrificial product, but it has a sanctity which is resemblant to and similar to kadshim as opposed to regular non-sanctified chulin food. So this manifests in a number of ways. First and most striking is that the consumption of truma is restricted to kohanim and their households. So as I enumerated, the Rambam counts a number of mitzvahs that are restricting who can eat the truma, and that, of course, would signify that's the primary issue of its kedusha. So we were talking about a kohen here, as well as a kohen's wife and his children, as well as the property he owns, assuming that it's appropriate for them. So that is to say, if you have oats growing in the backyard, and the oats became truma oats, and the kohen gets these truma oats, he can eat them for oatmeal, or he can feed it to the horses, because a normal use of oats is to feed horses, etc. Anybody else may not eat truma. So just to illustrate the point, for example, if a kohen is inviting you for dinner on Friday night Shabbos, you cannot eat his truma. He couldn't give it to you if you wanted to, because you're disallowed from eating it. A person who does eat truma, who is not a kohen, or otherwise authorized to eat truma as a member of the kohen's household, suffers the consequence of misa bidei shamayim, which means literally death at the hands of heaven, meaning premature death. So it's quite a severe penalty, worse than a generic prohibition. Like, so in other words, it's worse than eating bacon. It's worse than that. Truma, eating truma is worse than that. It carries not just a generic lav, it actually carries misa bidei shamayim. Even when you're a kohen, you have restrictions on when and how you can eat the truma. First of all, you have to be tahor. You can't be, ritually impure, defiled in some way, having been exposed to tumah. And what's remarkable about truma is that it actually is more sensitive to tumah than non-truma foods. So things that are non-truma foods are called chulin, just generic food. So chulin can be what's called a sheni l'tumah. Let me explain that for a minute in case you're not familiar. There are, if you count them in the Torah, by my counting, there are a total of 13 different sources of tuma in the Torah. Let's call those, to be simple here, avos tuma. They're different sources of tuma that are av, and av means the father, the source. When a tuma source comes into direct contact or otherwise conveys its tumah to a recipient, that recipient is called a vlad, a child of the tumah, meaning it's not the source of it, but now it's become contaminated by its exposure to the tumah source. And that various types of things, specifically four types of things, adam, people, kalim, utensils, ochlin, food, and mashkin, drink, can receive tumah from a source. And when it does, that recipient is called a vlad, generically, just meaning a recipient of tumah. But we keep track of how many generations this recipient is removed from the source. So if it's a first generation removed, meaning, for example, let's use as our tumah source a dead rat, a rat's a sheretz. When they're dead, they convey tumah through maga, direct contact. So if I have a dead rat, it's an alpha tumah, source of tumah from the Torah. And if the dead rat touches my pot, so my pot becomes a vlad, a child of tumah, it becomes contaminated, and we'll call the pot a rishon, a first degree removed from the source, because it came, it's first degree separate, one degree of separation from the original source of tumah. If that pot, in that pot I cook myself some oatmeal, let's say, so the oatmeal becomes tame also, and if we're talking about exposure from the pot to the oats would become a sheni l'tumah, second degree, because 2 degrees of separation, the rat was the source, then to the pot first, then to the oatmeal second. Okay, when it comes to chulin, that's the end of the chain. I'm ignoring derabanans about liquids, forget that for now. There's no way for chulin to become a shlishi l'tumah. There's no such thing as a 3 degrees of separation for regular food. So for argument's sake, if I take a carrot and dip it in the oatmeal or whatever the story is, ignoring any rabbinic issues about anything, the carrot does not become tummy, because a carrot can't become a shlishi. A regular chulin food can't become a shlishi, a third degree removed. However, chulin can. So that means if it wasn't just any old... Did I say chulin can? Excuse me.